It's the House Labor Committee meeting on Wednesday, April 27, 7 p.m., Subcommittee on Workers' Comp Benefit Bills, Hearing Room E, State Capitol.
House Subcommittee on Workers' Compensation Benefits Bills is in session. All members are present. Representative Johnson is in the adjacent room taking a vote in the Housing Committee. The first bill, well, let me outline what we're going to do tonight based on the agenda. We are going to take House Bill 2700 first, and then we are going to take testimony on House Bills 2806, 2831, 2913, and 2603.
The
2914. The balance of the bills have been extensively heard. We will basically be having a work session and take selective testimony on the balance of the bills, testimony to speak to any potential amendments and fiscal impact statements we've asked for. House Bill 2700, Mr. Whalen, you want to come up here? And I think there's some questions from the committee concerning I guess we're in kind of in a state of suspension until Representative Johnson gets back, though. So.
Do we have the bill as amended, Mr. Chairman? Was that printed?
We do, and it's hand engrossed. We did adopt the amendment as proposed by the proponents the last time.
Here it is.
Okay. I'm sorry, we have other people signed up here, too.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Representative Shipwreck.
Since the last subcommittee, I was had asked that we not take any action until we'd spoken to Mr. Whalen, and we have a copy of the amendments, and if he could briefly restate his intent of amending the original bill, appreciate it.
Okay. Tom Whalen, Oregon State Firefighters Council. Representative Shipwreck, the amendment you have before you tonight is a step downward from the conclusive presumption that we originally asked for, and a step upward from the current evidentiary standard that has to be met by an insurer or an employer to deny a heart and lung benefit for firefighters. We, at the time we introduced a conclusive presumption, we were experiencing firefighters being, in our opinion, unjustly denied benefits for heart and lung disabilities. The evidence that we introduced, including evidence by a research cardiologist, reflects our belief that the job and the day-to-day stresses, both emotional and physical, have an ultimate wear and tear on the body that exceeds that which would ordinarily be expected in a human being, and that accounts for our pronounced risk for heart and lung disabilities that goes way beyond what the average worker experiences. After listening to the testimony of the opponents, which was put forth in good faith, and I frankly had to agree that there were going to be instances in which, if a conclusive presumption became law, we'd have undeserving claimants getting heart and lung disabilities, where even if the insurer was able to point to another specific cause. That obviously is not in the best interest of all parties concerned, particularly the taxpayer. We then are left with one stopping off point between where we are now, where claims can be denied by the mystical belief by some physician or physicians that the job experiences of firefighters simply don't cause heart and lung disability, and the ultimate conclusive presumption. That standard is up from the preponderance of evidence that it now stands, which is, what, 51% of attorneys tell me. And a clear and convincing standard is a somewhat higher standard. Where that range falls, I don't know, 60 to 70%, I'm not sure, but it's admittedly a higher standard. This gets us closer to our desired goal of denying claims only when there is a clear picture that some other medical causation was at work here than the workplace. That basically is where we are now, and there's just one, as I indicated, maybe repeating myself, but there's just that one stopping off place between a disputable presumption and a conclusive presumption, neither one of which are desirable.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, I believe you requested that Jeanette Lawner be called back.
Yes, if that's...
I don't really want to have to pick up again. Tell you the truth.
Yeah. Who is he?
Portland lawyer.
Yes.
Yes.
Are you?
Representative
Johnson. I was just concerned about the case that you described in your prior, when you appeared before, and I had heard the comment made that it was your feeling that the Wright versus Safe case tightened the standard somewhat above the current standard, and I just wanted to hear your expression of that view and how you got to that assumption.
Well, I have...
Jeanette, for the record.
I'm sorry. My name is Jeanette Lawner. I'm an assistant city attorney for the city of Salem. At the time I testified previously, I believe I indicated in response to a question from Representative Hanlon that I had never read Wright versus Safe, and I wasn't familiar with it. Mr. Dearborn, who is our personnel director, made a few comments on it. We then returned to the office and looked through that case, and I did produce in writing for you a memo, yes, which represented what we believe is an interpretation of the Wright versus Safe case. Whether it can be characterized as tightening up the burden of proof or not, I'm not quite sure. I believe I expressed in that letter to the committee that what the Wright versus Safe case did was, for purposes of workers' compensation claims, at least firefighter workers' compensation claims, it did not follow the, quote, bursting bubble theory of presumptions, but rather gave to the presumption the weight of evidence so that it could be weighed against contrary medical evidence which would be produced by the insurer or the employer. I was offering that those comments in response to what Representative Hanlon had said at the time of the hearing.
Do we have the letter?
I had been furnished a copy by our staff counsel earlier in the day.
April 13th? Is that the one?
26th.
I don't know
that a copy was distributed to the members even. I was given this because I had been asked for the letter.
Several copies were delivered to the committee, but I don't know of their distribution.
I think they went to offices.
Oh, okay. Fine. All right. Well, I appreciate your comments. I just wanted to hear what you had.
Okay. Well, also, I had been asked to, if I may, to come here this evening and make a comment or two on the new amendments which have been proposed by the firefighters, if I may. As I indicated to the committee earlier, my practice does not include doing workers' compensation. However, Dick Lang, who is the workers' compensation counsel for the city of Salem, or does a substantial amount of that work, is here and would like to make
Mr.
some comments.
Mr. Lang, why don't you just come on right up? We're going to try and keep the testimony on the bills we've already heard three or four times reasonably short and get public testimony on those that are either new or have substantial new amendments.
Okay. I do, however, have one comment, and that is that it was my understanding that part of, at least, the original reason for the proposal by the firefighters was to simplify the process for those firefighters who were deserving of workers' comp benefits for their heart and lung disease. It appears to, certainly the conclusive presumption simplifies that process. It ends it, the inquiry, once the facts that establish the presumption are presented. I believe that the present set of amendments does nothing to simplify the process. Rather, it basically retains the same process. It does put a higher standard upon the employer or insurer, and what that higher standard might mean in terms of putting together a case from the city's or employer side, I cannot say. But I do believe that if one of the reasons for originally putting forth the conclusive presumption was to aid deserving firefighters in simply receiving the benefits to which they were due, that these amendments do not accomplish that. And I would ask, I guess, Mr. Lang, if the committee please, to make some comments perhaps on the practical effect of this change.
Well, I'm going to back up a little bit. And
Mr. Lang, would you introduce yourself?
Yeah, Dick Lang. I'm a lawyer in Portland. I'm with the firm of Mitchell, Lang, and Smith, and I do a substantial amount of workers' compensation work and have done so since the three-way bill, and my firm does some work for the city of Salem. I'm going to back up a little bit and give just a little bit of my thoughts on the presumptions. Customarily, in a workers' compensation claim or in any type of a claim, the burden of proof is normally on the worker to prove his case. In a fireman's case, there is a disputable presumption, as everyone knows, that he has a compensable claim. Then the burden of what the law says going forward with the evidence shifts to the employer to disprove that claim with better evidence, to characterize it simply. It wouldn't be fair to have, so in a fireman's case, he has a better world for making a workers' comp claim than any other worker, because if he has a heart attack, for instance, there's a disputable presumption it's compensable. Not so in other areas of workers' compensation law. The worker has to prove his case by what the law says a preponderance of medical evidence, which means a greater weight of the evidence, which could be characterized as 51%. So a fireman already has the advantage of having a disputable presumption that his claim is compensable. The employer now has to come in and prove with better evidence that it's not compensable. The customary proof that's needed in a workers' comp claim or in any civil lawsuit is a preponderance of the evidence, which means a greater weight of the evidence, which the law pretty much it's customary for the law to deal with that quantum of evidence, the preponderance of evidence or the greater weight of evidence. In some cases in the law, the quantum of proof is clear and convincing evidence, and the dictionary definition of clear and convincing evidence does create a higher standard. The legal dictionary says beyond a reasonable doubt or beyond a well-founded doubt. You're kind of getting into the burden that's required in a criminal case to prove that somebody's guilty of a crime. My thought is that the fireman already has an advantage because he's got a disputable presumption that his case is compensable. Then the city or the employer has to prove it's not. That as a matter of fairness, the burden of proof ought to be preponderance of the evidence, as it is in all other workers' comp claims and general civil litigation. Preponderance of the evidence, by definition, just simply means a greater weight of the evidence. A fireman has a heart attack, the other conditions being met, it's then up to the city to prove that it's not compensable, and the proof is by medical evidence. We're simply talking about comparing medical evidence with other medical evidence to determine if it is or isn't compensable. I think each case because of the nature of the system, has to be rise and fall individually on its own evidence. It certainly wouldn't be fair to say that there was a conclusive presumption that every heart attack that every fireman had was compensable. But in sticking with the traditional yardstick that the law uses, I think preponderance of the evidence as opposed to clear and convincing should be used. That's what we're used to dealing with in the law.
Representative Johnson?
Would you say that that would be a higher standard than, or you're saying that would be a higher standard than that presently is in the law?
I think that the law now, no, that would be what the law is now.
Oh, that's what the law is now.
Yeah, if it says disputable presumption and then it says that the employer then has to disprove that, has the burden of going forward with the evidence, it's implicit in that it means preponderance of evidence.
So you're saying basically no change is what you believe is appropriate.
Perhaps add the words preponderance of the evidence. It already means that, but maybe that would clarify it. Typically, a jury in a civil case is told, after listening to all the evidence in the case, that they're to weigh the evidence in the case and that the burden is preponderance of the evidence and that the greater weight of the evidence means the preponderance of the evidence. And 51% is probably what we're saying. Mm-hmm. So that a fact finder, a hearing officer or a referee would look at medical reports submitted by a claimant and medical reports submitted by the city or the employer and simply look at the ones that they thought were more weighty and make their decision that way. There's a lot of subjective to it, whether you call it preponderance of the evidence or greater weight of the evidence or clear and convincing. But I think in sticking with the tradition of the law that leave it the way it is now or say preponderance of the evidence.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
Mr. Lang, just a question based on your testimony. There's a separate criminal standard beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's a higher standard than is proposed in this bill.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for taking it.
You bet.
Here, appreciate it.
We have the bill before us as amended, and we have adopted the amendments.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Shiprock.
I would move House Bill 2700 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Representative Shiprock moves HB 2700 as amended April 19th, 1983 to the full committee. Clerk, call the roll.
Johnson?
No.
Shiprock?
Aye.
Hanlon?
Aye. We have, make it official. We have before us, and we're a little informal here on the bills that are up. At these night meetings, we get more and more informal. We have HB 2806, 2831, 2914. And is it 2603 or 2601?
It's 01.
It is 01. Okay. Those bills have not yet been heard. And we have a sign-up sheet, and I understand there's some people that have come some distance. Let me just call Susan Olson. And I
or if you'd like to come up together.
Or the people, you can bring up whoever you want.
Which bill are we going to go
this on? This is, they're signed up on 2914, but I will encourage you to speak to any of the bills that I just listed that you wish to speak to. If that's the only one, fine.
Labor Committee and
thank you.
Subcommittee and appreciate your coming 250 miles to talk to us.
Thank you. I'll start. I'm Susan Olson, Administrator of Employee Benefits with Boise Cascade Corporation. I'm here primarily representing the Greater Medford Chamber of Commerce, who requested that this bill, HB 2914, be introduced. I am also speaking in support of the bill as an employee of Boise Cascade Corporation. HB 2914 was originally submitted in four separate bill drafts. In considering this bill, we would like to ask that the committee consider each four proposals separately and apart from the others, and if one, for instance, does not meet with the approval of the committee, that the bill in part does not pass, to sacrifice the other three or two. HB 2914 addresses sections in the workers' compensation law which currently promote utilization of the system beyond its intent and purpose. This bill does not eliminate any legitimate benefits entitled to workers, but continues to provide all necessary benefits in a more cost-effective manner. It would eliminate unnecessary expenses now being paid under workers' compensation, unnecessary costs which are filtered to all Oregonians. Aside from my professional interests as a citizen of Oregon, I am concerned with economic waste. By Section 2 is the first proposal, which provides credence to existing statutory language, that being prior to enrollment in a vocational rehabilitation program, it shall first be determined that that individual cannot return to his regular job or any modified suitable job which is available at that time. What House Bill 2914 proposes is that once that has ultimately been established, and this is usually by medical opinion, the worker should waive reinstatement to that regular job and any modified or suitable jobs that were considered prior to his enrollment in the program. The waiver would not apply to any suitable jobs which may become available after enrollment or at a later time. The problem that results with the existing language on numerous occasions is that workers enter vocational rehabilitation programs, and after they've completed or they've withdrawn from the program, after the vocational dollars have been spent, that worker then decides that he or she possibly can or actually can return to the regular job with that date of injury employer and obtains a medical release from oftentimes another doctor, presents it to the employer, and on the basis of that, the employer is obligated to return that employee back to work. Obviously unnecessary dollars being spent. The vocational rehabilitation reserve comprises approximately two-thirds of the of Oregon employers' assessments to the state of Oregon, and expenditures from that reserve are overwhelming. Unnecessary expense is exemplified by the example above, places undue financial burden to the system and ultimately could deprive workers from who legitimately do need vocational assistance. An absolute determination prior to enrollment would instill some sense of responsibility and an incentive for a worker to proceed in excelling in an identified goal. Section 3 proposes to eliminate double compensation to an injured worker that results in contradictory eligibility criteria for both employment security and workers' compensation benefits. The law presently provides that an injured worker who has returned to work in a modified capacity and who later becomes subject to a layoff along with other workers resumes eligibility for temporary total disability and also is eligible to draw unemployment benefits. It is our feeling that this conflicting criteria is not the intent of the law and is not in the best interest of the worker. Compensation levels resulting from this doubling of compensation exceeds even that provided by the workers' compensation law, and could possibly result in extended disability for financial reward. Noting also that compensating an injured worker in this manner discriminates against the uninjured worker in a layoff situation. Section 4, this amendment pertains to workers who sustained injury prior to retirement and whose claims subsequent to retirement are reopened for aggravated disability. The design of temporary total disability and temporary partial disability benefits are to compensate for lost wages. A claimant drawing retirement pension, Social Security, or a claimant who has voluntarily retired from the workforce and is dependent on another source of income as a dependent experiences no loss of wages when in fact additional medical treatment is necessary. If there's no loss of wages, it's our feeling the worker should not be entitled for such, or entitled to compensation for such, by way of temporary total disability and temporary partial disability benefits. It should be noting in making this proposal, it would not affect in any way the medical benefits a worker is entitled to or the evaluation process on reopened claims. Incidental to this, I obtained some statistics from the Workers' Compensation Department Research Division. 1981, there were 37,498 disabling claims filed, 3,613 of which were age 55 or above, comprising 9.6%. 1,530 of that same amount were age 60 or above, comprising 4.1%. In 1982, 31,535 disabling claims were filed, 3,213 age 55 or above, comprising 10.2%, 1,348 age 60 or above, comprising 4.3%. Not a large percentage, but a substantial percentage of individuals who are approaching retirement age and could conceivably experience aggravation beyond a retirement date. Section 5 merely conforms existing language to the amendments contained in Section 4. Section 6, the fourth proposal found here, amends and provides for the stay of permanent partial disability awards pending a request for review or court appeal by an employer or insurer. The law presently provides for payment pending appeal and no obligation on the part of the claimant to repay if, in fact, that award is found inappropriate. Because the monies have already been expended and are not recoverable, an appeal by an employer or insurer becomes a matter of principle alone and is not a cost-effective endeavor. In addition, existing language, ORS 656313, and by administrative rule 43654-320 suggests that permanent partial disability awards pending appeal and ultimately found to be excessive and reduced or altogether eliminated may not be used as overpayment against any future awards should that claim aggravate. Those are purely wasted dollars when in fact it's ultimately determined that the claimant was not entitled to the money to begin with. PPD awards are made following any disabling time away from work, medical recovery, and vocational training if necessary, and as such would not, or a stay of that award would not substantially burden the worker financially. It's our feeling that PPD awards, permanent partial disability awards, should not be paid until the matter is finally adjudicated, as is the case in civil court, liability suits. In summary, HB 2914 proposes amendments which do not detract from legitimate benefits of workers. Oregon employers should be responsible for reasonable and fair provisions, but should not be held responsible for excessive, unnecessary, and unnecessary expenditures. Such undue financial burden threatens the stability of our economy and job security. workers' compensation costs are overwhelming for Oregon industry. With Oregon businesses just recently facing economic recovery, an effort should be made to eliminate unnecessary expense. Economic development in Oregon is dependent in a large part on the employer responsibilities mandated by law. The economic stability in Oregon is in jeopardy if these unreasonable and excessive expenses are allowed to continue. The Medford Chamber of Commerce respectfully urges your consideration of these proposals for passage.
Thanks, Susan. Thank you. And the other two of you have presentations to make.
Representative Hanlon, my name is Scott Plouse. I'm with the firm of Cowling and Heisel in Medford. We do both defense and claimants work down there. I'm here primarily to provide moral support to Susan, and I have to admit that I've been a workers' comp attorney in Oregon only about 7 months. But maybe I can give you a little bit of a subjective view from the trenches. I did the original draftsmanship on the bills, and I guess
there's a correspondence which should be entered in the record of this bill in support of House Bill 2914. The first is a letter dated April 26th from Husky Industries and signed by Harvey Stapler, plant superintendent. The second, a letter dated April 27th, 1983 from Rogue Valley Memorial Hospital and signed by Dennis Olson, risk manager, both in support of the bill.
Thank you. The next bill that we have people signed up on tonight, and they're all locals, is House Bill 2831. Mr. Kirk Berger.
Maybe we should ask if anybody else wanted to appear on that bill.
Just a second, Mr. Berger. Were there others that wished to appear on 2913? 14.
Thank you, Mr.
Okay. Mr. Goss.
Get behind us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dick Goss. I represent the American Insurance Association. It may come as a surprise to the chairman. I wish to testify against Section 4 of 2914, which would provide for discontinuing TDD benefits for those people who have voluntarily removed themselves from the labor market. There are many reasons why you know, a worker may remove himself from the labor market, and it may be related to his or her disability. I also have served in the past as a pro tem workers' comp referee and as a claimant's attorney, and it's not only because somebody has voluntarily retired from the labor market for other reasons that this might occur. Some people may remove themselves from the labor market because of their injury, and instead of trying to endure working with that injury because they have another spouse or perhaps another source of income, they make the choice. But it's not particularly a voluntary choice, given the injury that they have. I probably would not hesitate if this bill spoke to those people who have taken some kind of retirement plan, whether it be Social Security or a private retirement plan. But there are many people out there who are not working for many reasons, and I don't think they should be denied the workers' comp benefits just because of those reasons. And it may not be purely, and it may very well be because of their injury that they're no longer working, and that would be an ironic situation that they should be denied workers' comp benefits because they have taken themselves out of the labor market because of their injury. Thank you.
House Bill 2831, with apologies, Mr. Berger.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, representing the Kirk Berger, representing the League of Oregon Cities, Association of Oregon Counties. What we bring to you tonight is essentially a conceptual bill that we have introduced the last two sessions, to my knowledge, maybe even more than that. The issue is the coordination of disability benefits that are received by public employees who are subject to the public employee retirement system as well as workers' compensation system and Social Security. The issue is essentially here because under the public employee retirement system, we have a duty disability allowance. And we have found in the past, primarily through research that was done during the 1979 session by a former safety director for the state of Oregon, identified a number of examples of employees on a duty disability who, with combined benefits between workers' compensation, PERS, and Social Security, have tax-free payments in excess of their gross salary during the time that they were working. Our concern is that we think this may not be the best use of public tax dollars, and would suggest that we think there have been concerns raised about the bill and the way it's drafted and whether it can be administered effectively the way it's drafted. It is essentially an offset against PERS benefits. And I have a letter that was submitted last session by PERS to the House Labor Committee, and I apologize for not having copies. I went to make some tonight, and our Xerox machine was inoperative, or at least I couldn't figure out how to fix it. So I will get those for you and submit them tomorrow morning. But we have a letter that suggests that some of the administrative problems that we used to think were there in the bill are no longer there, in part because of information that is available through workers' comp. And Roy Green may want to speak to some of the issues involved in this bill and how it could be administered. But if there is an interest in the concept in dealing with this problem, I think we can, between workers' comp and ourselves and PERS, we could probably sit down and figure out how to draft it in a way that would make it workable. But we think it is a very legitimate issue to be addressed, and would certainly like to see the issue carried forward in this committee.
Representative Johnson.
In your past efforts, have there been any fiscal studies done on how much money is involved with this issue?
There's no.
People are,
well, what I can there? I can tell you that last session, PERS looked through their files and found that they were currently in 1981, there were about 2,600. Disability awards under PERS. 530 of those or so were duty disability awards, and about 19, almost 1,700 were non-duty disability awards. So in turn, we're talking about the duty disability where we're talking about the combination between workers' comp and PERS. So there were about 534 cases to be exact in 1981 that were people under PERS were receiving a duty disability and also would have been receiving some award through workers' compensation. We do not know to what extent each of those cases would represent payments in excess of their previous salary. So we have not, you know, we have not gone through and identified each one of those people and done an assessment of what the actual savings would be. But based on the examples that we have from, again, 1979, case of a state police officer who had a gross salary of $1,045, and after their injury, just between workers' comp and PERS, without considering Social Security, had a net tax-free income of $1,160. So, $1,045 monthly gross salary prior to the injury, and $1,160 tax-free income between workers' comp and PERS afterwards. A firefighter who had a gross salary of $1,500 and a net tax-free income of $1,600 after injury. A deputy sheriff with a gross salary of $1,400 and a workers' comp PERS combined net tax-free income of $1,600. Say, we have not analyzed every case to determine what the full impact would be, but we think the concept is a worthy one, and so we'd like to see it pursued.
Questions of Mr. Berger? Mr. Green? Thank you, Kirk.
Just briefly, Chairperson, my name is Roy Green, the Director of Workers' Compensation Department. The inclusion of Social Security benefits as an offset may be illegal. If I remember rightly, there are 14 states in which this is an integral part of their current legislation, that is, legislation which is in effect. But I believe there is a federal law which says that except for those 14, you can't offset other benefits with Social Security benefits. So if this is to be given consideration, that should be investigated carefully. That's the only concern I have about it, Mr. Chairman. I can tell you how it occurred. There are in the PERS, there are annually several cases in which the total benefits which they're receiving from the state, that is either under workers' comp and PERS disability, is in excess of their wage at time of injury. And of course, this brings up the specter of ability to return a person to work eventually, because it's an absolute disincentive to return to work. But that was the ideology of it.
Mr. Green, Representative Johnson, I've got a question on that. If I want to try and make sure I understand you correctly. We're one of the 14 states, are we not, with regard to Social Security disability offset? Is that correct?
I believe it's the other way around. Am I correct? Now, I'll have to examine that more carefully, but it's something that should be examined very, very carefully if you're going to consider this bill seriously.
But it's your understanding of the federal law that it no longer would allow
offset. That's correct.
By state law.
In other words, if we now put this into effect, it would not be allowed.
Thank you.
I just want to make a comment for the members of the audience that I am working in two committees, and they have to have me to get some bills out the next door, so that's why I'm running back and forth. I apologize, but it does create problems when we have overlaps like this.
Speaking of the devil.
Am I?
Are you wanted? I think you wanted. Really.
No.
Maybe not.
That was not the signal.
Okay. I saw your
Jennifer, did you have something?
No.
The next bill up, and these are bills we've heard, it seems like, and heard and heard and heard. The next bill up is 2376.
I have signed up Mr. Green. Mr. Green, did you have some comments with reference to that bill?
Mr. Chairperson, my name is Roy Green. Only that I have asked the National Council to get several things for us. One, the possible decrease in the costs and the rates as a result of using historical wage, and secondly, the increases, and I asked them to give it to us at 125, 133 and a third, 150, 166 and two-thirds, 175 and 200%, so that we would have a lot of alternatives to examine on that. And I hope to have that from them tomorrow afternoon by 1:30, which is 4:30 their time. That's the only thing I have to offer.
I think we just pass it on to the committee and let the information come when it can. Right.
I think that's correct. Mr. Any further questions of Mr. Green on this bill?
You see Jumpy Joe over there.
Mr. Kalinowski, we had Mr. Green's testimony on the prior bill relating to Social Security offset, and I know you've testified twice before on this. Let me ask you to come up briefly, but not to repeat anything earlier. I hate to limit it, but we're going to move it along.
Mr. Chairman, Jack Kalinowski, Associated General Contractors. Absolutely no problem with that. At the termination of your hearing the other night on House Bill 2376, there were still some remaining questions regarding Social Security retirement offsets. I testified to you that they were allowable if the Social Security entitlement was a disability entitlement. Questions came up as to retirement Social Security payments to an injured worker. Mr. Chairman, I went to the trouble of calling Representative Congressman Weaver's office, and I talked to his assistant, who I'm told is very familiar with Social Security laws. And his name is Kevin Harang, H-A-R-R-A-N-G. I gave Mr. Harang the questions, and then later in the day, he phoned me back saying, I have contacted the Social Security Administration, and here's what they tell me. Yes, Oregon can continue its offset of disability Social Security payments. Number two, Social Security disability payments change to retirement benefits at age 65. The Congress did not take any action to disallow a state legislature from offsetting Social Security retirement benefits from workers' compensation benefits. So the Oregon legislature has no impediment from any action of the Congress if they choose, and I hope they do choose, to take this action. Fourthly, Social Security does not offset any workers' compensation entitlements from their retirement benefits. The only impediment on anybody, whether that person had prior to age 65 been receiving disability benefits or not, is they cannot earn more than $6,600 in any given year without suffering some reduction if they earn more than $6,600 a year in their Social Security retirement entitlement. He went on to explain very carefully that workers' compensation benefits received after by the claimant after age 65 are not considered income. I think all the questions that you had asked, Mr. Chairman, have been answered. And on House Bill 2376, that is one of our the two amendments that we have submitted to this committee.
Questions?
Appreciate your taking the trouble to get that information for us.
Mr. Kalinowski, let me ask a question. Do you see any contradictions or anything different in the testimony you just offered in the testimony Mr. Green offered just prior to you?
I wasn't here to hear his testimony. I was in the next hearing room. I'm testifying on a completely different bill.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Young. My question of you, I think, is do you have anything material to follow up on the same subject matter that was just spoken to?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Larry Young, Administrator of the Compliance Division, Workers' Compensation Department. I had checked with the local Social Security Administration yesterday and got the call back today, and they provided exactly the same information that Mr. Kalinowski just testified to.
Thank you. I think that ends the testimony. We have before us House Bill 2376, and we have adopted the amendment relating to a notification about extension of the calendar quarter, in other words, interweaving the unemployment statute notice with the workers' comp statute. That was the AFL amendment of March 9th. We adopted that at our last work session. We have had extensive testimony on 2376. It's my understanding Mr. Green will have available some fiscal impact for the full committee no matter what.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Shipwreck.
I would like to move House Bill 2376 as amended to the full committee with no recommendation till we see the... I assume we'll have that for Friday.
I won't oppose that. Go ahead.
Any opposition to that motion? Hearing none, so ordered. Next, we're going to take House Bill 2379. And that is thank you. We have 2379. We have Mr. Green signed up, and as I recall, Mr. Green, you had some potential fiscal information for us.
Yes, Mr. Chairperson. My name is Roy Green. The first thing I should explain that 2379 is section is 656204. But this also affects directly 656208, which is death during permanent total disability. 208, when there is when a permanent total disability claimant dies during the period of total permanent disability and is survived by a spouse and or dependent children, the surviving spouse and or dependent children then become subject to the benefits of 656204, and therefore this bill has a double effect. I believe you have been told that the cost of the 204 part of 656204 is approximately 2% increase. The cost of the 208 part of 204 is slightly less than 2%, and again, I will have that information properly, hopefully by tomorrow afternoon, officially from the National Council. But again, I should excuse.
When you say 2%, are you talking 2%
of increase in the rate structure?
In the rate, in the rate increase of 2%.
Yes, sir.
To implement those. Okay.
Under present law, a surviving or a spouse of a permanent total disability claimant and the first four other dependents are eligible for $5 per week during the period of permanent total disability. When the surviving spouse or when the permanent total disability claimant dies for any reason whatsoever, the surviving spouse becomes, in effect, the widow of a fatally injured worker. And the children also become that. The children, the first two children, go to from $21.75 a month to $150 a month. And the next seven children go from, or the next two children, rather, go from $21.75 a month to $50 a month, and then there's an additional five children who would also be eligible for $50 a month if the permanent total disability claimant fathered the total of the seven. Under the present average weekly wage, the widow at 50% goes from $21.75 a month to $623.95 a month. And that's at 50% of the average weekly wage. This bill would increase that by one-third, exactly. The children would not be increased, obviously. There's no change in the children.
Mr. Green, are you speaking to 2379?
Yes.
As printed?
Yes, sir.
I think I, Mr. Chair, Mr. Green lost me there for a minute, too. I think I'm getting back on track. I looked up 208, which we don't have in this.
No, it isn't in there. It automatically, 208 automatically uses the benefits of 204.
Mm-hmm. That's a new element.
Just by reference. So that this affects both of those, even though it isn't in the law, it affects both of them automatically.
So, if I might follow up, Mr. Green, you're talking about the fiscal impact for the bill as originally printed. Is that what you have before you, or do you have amendments? I'm just trying to get it straight.
I have only the 66 and two-thirds percent of wages
at time of injury.
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
I understand that the $5,000 has been deleted. Am I correct?
That's okay. Correct.
So the only thing we're concerned about is the 66 and two-thirds of the average weekly wage.
And there is an amendment.
Okay. That is not amended, is it?
Yes, it's been amended to whichever is greater change the FLCIO put in. We should get a copy. If you're going to do a fiscal, well, you might want to include that concern to get you that.
Now I am confused. Mr. Green, the bill as originally printed speaks to 66 and two-thirds percent of wages received by the worker at time of injury and deletes the old 50% of average weekly wage. Can you be specific in what fiscal implications you were talking to?
You must have made an assumption that it was at the time of death.
Was your testimony related to the average week, an increase in a percent of the average weekly wage?
Yes, sir.
That's what I thought it was.
Has there been an amendment to that then?
There has not. My question of you then is, what percent of average weekly wage were you speaking to? Because I don't think we clearly understood you.
Well, I was speaking of the two-thirds of the average weekly wage.
You were speaking for an increase from 50% of the average weekly wage to two-thirds of the average weekly wage.
That's right.
Okay.
And as I understand it, is that not the amendment or was a proposal by AFL-CIO? Am I correct?
I don't believe that's a proposal.
I don't believe that is, no, but that may be useful information.
I think, Mr.
Representative Shipwreck.
I think we did ask Mr. Young last meeting,
yes,
if he would get us those numbers,
yes,
for the so the committee could look at some different alternatives.
We have asked for those, and although they the information came back at that it would be a total of a little slightly less than 4%, I asked that it be made official, and hopefully by tomorrow afternoon we'll have some official information.
If I might follow up on that, Mr. Green, because I want to get this straight. What 66 and two-thirds of the average weekly wage would also translate to 50% of 133% of average weekly wage. Am I correct?
No. Yes, it would.
Yeah. Okay, so either one,
yeah,
however you want to look at it.
But we are also asking for that percentage or that cost, which is based on the worker's wage at time.